They do vital work and have saved countless lives, maybe even the life of someone you love and hold dear. Find them on the web at outsidein.org. That's outsidein.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Many thanks to my guests, Wanda Bertram from the Prison Policy Initiative and Haven Wheelock from Outside In. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just a so long. Soul's intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness. Animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive.
An interactive library of high quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Welcome to another edition of LTAR, Let's Talk About Race. On this edition, we are examining the drug crisis in America, primarily fentanyl and opioids. We will look at the racial and ethnic disparities and how drug use is viewed and prosecuted in America, as well as the impact of harm reduction strategies. How does the approach to the overdose crisis differ from the approach to the crack cocaine crisis in the late 1980s and 90s? This segment is hosted by Althea Billings. Our proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee, is on assignment.
This is LTAR, Let's Talk About Race, the episode, Death by One Pill. Xylazine, an animal tranquilizer, is now a factor in the ongoing fentanyl opioid crisis. They're talking about us being in the third wave. And there's a lot to discuss, especially how race factors into what has long been considered a white issue. So I want to go to our panelists for our first question here. Considering this as perhaps the third wave of the opioid crisis, as some experts are calling it, what are the aspects of the history of the quote-unquote war on drugs that are relevant to the current overdose crisis? Let's start with Reverend Cecil.
If one goes back to the 1920s, 1930s, and the war on drugs started by people such as the director of the FBI, we see that at an early time, this war on drugs was often a war on black people. The obsession with marijuana and its impact on the music community and targeting jazz musicians, particularly black musicians, was a beginning of a decade-long pursuit of black people and the association of black people with illegal drugs. We can fast forward and see how it's connected to the incarceration rate, the prison industrial complex, and the continued assault on the black community. This assault, which was seen as an attack on drugs, was indeed an attack on the black community.
The so-called drug war led to the criminalization of people of color, particularly young black people, in the late 1980s and 1990s. Individually, family wealth was eroded, communities became war zones, and black-on-black crime escalated. And now the drug crisis has spread to wider cities and towns, and all of America is experiencing what the black community suffered, or are they?
Fast forward to 2023 and this so-called third raid of the opioid crisis. A lot of it has focused on the impact on white community. This may be a good thing in that it will shift the focus from pursuing people and arresting people and maybe put the emphasis on healing and health and the possibility of people being restored to healthier conditions. Having said that, the reality is black and brown communities all continue to be impacted by this crisis, and that although the perception is that it is a predominantly white phenomenon in rural community, it continues to have a devastating impact on black and brown communities. So maybe black and brown people will have more access to services, and maybe the withdrawal from prosecution of those who are taking drugs will be helpful. I'll wait and see, but I hope that the transition from prosecution to healing will have an impact on black and brown communities.
Thank you, Cecil. Let's go to Nia and then Professor Johnson.
Thank you. Well, I feel like a Gen Xer that the war on drugs will always leave its mark on my generation specifically. I can still remember the comic book that I received in the fifth grade that was offered by Nancy Reagan, published by the government. And I remember our class going through this Just Say No exercise, as if it was that easy in our community that had already generationally been attacked by drugs. You know, it was heroin, cocaine. And then when crack cocaine came on the scene, it was a lot of my classmates who were involved in gang activity and ultimately lost their life because what funded gang activity was the drug sales, the drug market. So it's interesting when you say the war on drugs, those are some of the memories that come to my mind, and also how just the war on drugs infiltrated rap music at the time. That's all everybody was talking about, rapping about, even some of the materialistic sort of attributes that we have today started off with that drug trade. That's how young people used to get their money, So they could buy the gold chains and they could buy the Jordans and things like that. So as a child growing up in that time, it definitely has left a mark on me. And, you know, since its inception, the war on drugs has had racial disparities. In fact, I remember this growing up, but it didn't really resonate. So I went back and did some research, and it's that 100-to-1 crack versus powder cocaine sentencing disparity that might still be valid today. But the point is, like, a young brother, because this is typically in impoverished Black communities, that if they were distributing just 5 grams of crack cocaine, that carried a minimum 5-year federal prison sentence. However, if someone was distributing with intent to sell 500 grams of powder cocaine, that would carry the same 5-year mandatory sentence. So you would see a lot of young African-American, Black and Brown men and women who are in the prison system because of this disparity, because they were pushing, you know, the poor man's drug and not the rich Wall Street man's drug, which is the pure powder cocaine. And we still see this today with the opioid possession, that if someone was selling crack cocaine or a quote-unquote more ghetto drug, they would get more time, where possession of heroin and opioid gets you much smaller sentences. But also, first offenders weren't, you know, these minimum sort of maximum federal prison sentences, that first offenders with opioids might even get a sentence of probation and enrollment in a drug treatment program.
Thank you, Nia. Professor Johnson?
Yeah, so when I think back about the war on drugs, one of the things that comes to mind is Richard Nixon, because this is where this language, the war on drugs, where we tend to think that it started. And I just read a quote this evening from John Ehrlichman, who was an aide to Richard Nixon, who said it never was meant to be a war on drugs. And this is a quote: "We knew we couldn't make it legal to be either against the war or Black, but getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and Blacks with heroin, then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities," end quote. From the very beginning, this whole concept of war on drugs, which they also connected with the high crime rates they were experiencing during this time, it never was a war on drugs. It was the destruction of these communities so that they could advance their own agenda in terms of the war in Vietnam and also a war on Black people. I also think back to the war on drugs because I remember the Iran-Contra scandal, and that was selling arms and taking that money from the drugs that they dumped into Black communities to finance that. This war on drugs, I believe if the United States really wanted to have a war on drugs, we wouldn't have drugs. It's an industry, and that industry has had the greatest impact on Black people and communities of color. I agree that there was even some legislation during the Clinton administration that actually incentivized more prisons, giving money, you know, actually using money to incentivize the growth of that whole prison and incarceration industry. The war on drugs has really been a war on people of color.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. All of you lovely folks said a lot of the things that I was thinking about this question as well, reflecting on the war on drugs and how that informs what we're thinking about now with the opioid crisis. And even before the, as it's named, war on drugs, the criminalization of drugs, the Schedule Ones as we know them today, coincide with waves of immigration in the United States. So, for example, marijuana wasn't criminalized until there were Mexican immigrants in the United States. Opiates weren't criminalized until there was an influx of Chinese immigrants in the early 1900s, and so on and so forth. For pretty much any community that you can think of, this is the history that we see. And it's a means of stoking xenophobia, racism, classism. And it doesn't result in less people doing drugs, which I think is also worth noting here. And what we're looking at now is a little bit different in its own way, because we are talking about what was formerly considered a white issue and how opioid addicts have not been treated the same way as other addicts of other racial classes in the past.
You are listening to LTAR, Let's Talk About Race, The Pill of Death, The Fentanyl Crisis in America.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
My next question here goes into this. How has drug policy in the United States changed in response to the opioid or the fentanyl crisis? Let's start with Nia.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I'm born and bred West Coast in Portland, Oregon. And about the time I moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you know, the Rust Belt, that there was starting to be an increase in opioid use, fentanyl on the streets, but then also an increase in overdoses. In fact, from 2010 to 2019, rates of opioid-related mortality in Pennsylvania had an increase of nearly 475%. Being a resident that's lived here, I've seen the evolution of it. And just historically, it has, when you watch TV, it's a like a suburban or rural drug problem, right? It's young people, they get a hold of their parents' drugs, or they are a blue-collar worker, they hurt themselves, they're prescribed opiates, they become addicted. So the narrative on the white opioid drug user, as opposed in comparison to the African-American crack user, is that the person who is using crack had a character flaw, right? You know, there's something wrong with them. They live in the hood, so they're expected to use drugs. But no, not Mikey, right, who's from Ohio, and he wouldn't be involved in this. And therefore, that narrative has led to, like I mentioned before, different sentencing, and really that they're not sentenced to the penal system, but there's more of a push for substance abuse counseling and going to rehab and things like that, because, you know, it's the overprescription of the drug that's the issue, not the drug addiction. What's interesting is there's a larger community, African-American community in Pittsburgh, according to the statistics, that are starting to use and overdose on opioids with the fentanyl, and now you've got the trank. But specifically, what's interesting is that a white opioid addict, you know, for that loss of a better word for that, can go into CVS and they have insurance, and their private insurance will pay for Narcan or different types of medication that they use. However, you know, a low-income African-American person that's experiencing drug addiction, does Medicaid cover Narcan? In the article I read, the African-American community has less access to some of the resources that maybe the white addicts have. And it could be just because they've got access to private insurance and another group doesn't, but there definitely is a disparity between the two.
Thank you, Nia. Let's go to Professor Johnson.
My thoughts about what's happening in terms of the drug epidemic now versus before, I would agree that there was this different path, especially with cocaine, just as Nia has pointed out in her discussion. We saw a white face on the fentanyl epidemic from about 2012 to 2015. And then after that, the demographic shift. And then you start to see that more Black people are also ODing on these drugs, and they're ODing at a very important time in their life. So you're looking at the most productive time in their life. You know, they're between 18 and I think 35 are some of where the highest rates of ODs are happening, and more male than female. But now this is really negatively impacting the Black community. You're seeing that, as Nia articulated, the treatment, the access to drugs that can help, like bupropion, I think I'm saying that correctly, bupropion, which reduces the cravings and withdrawal symptoms while the patient goes through recovery treatment, is not available in the Black community. And also because the access to healthcare for communities of color is very different, what they have available in their communities. So I was really happy to read that there's some effort now, even in the private sector, to be able to open facilities in the communities that will reach out to these groups of people and provide that treatment, drugs for treatment, as well as counseling. The demographics are really changing, and it is becoming a significant problem for Black people, also Hispanics, in terms of the results. The other thing that's happened is that there is a broader understanding of the need to decriminalize drugs and to treat them differently. And we've seen a number of states move in that direction, to make personal use and differentiate that. And that, I think, has improved some responses in respect that fewer people will face criminal sentences for small possession. It will be interesting to see those states and how far they go with their programs in terms of approaching it as a health issue rather than a criminal issue.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Let's go to Reverend Cecil.
Yes, if I could continue on some of the points that the other panelists have made. I think it is important, as the professor just observed, is the move from making it a criminal issue in terms of drugs to a health issue. I think that is positive. The key thing is, as Nia mentioned, is access to health care. As Nia mentioned, and the access to health care depends a lot on income, and the need for people to have health care continues to be something that people struggle with. I think it's interesting that there are 10 states where the medication naloxone used for those who had an overdose is limited in 10 states in terms of how many doses you can be prescribed in a month. It is not surprising that most of those 10 states which limits it to the access to the medicine are located in the traditional red states in the South. This means that access to health care is important if we are going to really treat this problem, not as a criminal problem, but as a health problem. So we have to make sure that access is expanded to communities, poor communities that are limited, and that people have the ability to get the treatment that they need. I think it is good that there is a move away from the criminalization of drugs to seeing it, the problem, as a health crisis. The challenge is, when and will we be able to put the resources needed to make sure that all those who are suffering have access to good treatment, good care, and are able to live a full and healthy life. It's more than just a problem of access to health care. It's an access to good jobs. It's an access to good education. It's an access to all that we think of when we think of the ideals of our society. It's a challenge for all of us. It's a challenge for our society as we seek ways to expand understanding and access to health care, and a move away, which the others have said so eloquently, away from penalizing those who are addicted to seeking health care that they need. It's a challenge, and we will see whether our country, our states, are able to live up to that challenge.
Thank you, Cecil. All the panelists covered this quite well, the importance and really the quite a dynamic shift from considering. And actually, you know what? I don't think that the shift is fully there. I don't know that there is real agreement across groups, I suppose, that drug addiction is not a personal moral failing and therefore deserves to be punished. And I can connect this, I suppose, anecdotally with what we're seeing with the demographic change of just who is being impacted by fentanyl, by this new additive xylazine that we don't have an antidote for, as it has moved away from being a white issue and something that just happens to somebody. They got addicted to drugs. It wasn't their fault. It's because of the big companies. We should sue them, having that reaction versus, and that's taken us so far, right? We've gotten more healthcare options for people. There is movement towards the decriminalization of drugs, but I speak to you here from Portland, Oregon, where there is in our state a past drug decriminalization that was also supposed to go hand in hand with using cannabis tax dollars to fund addiction services and rehab services and things like that. Those things didn't line up, and now it is conservatives beating a drum that Measure 110, which was that measure, was a mistake, that decriminalizing drugs was a mistake. Look at our streets, look at the people. But it's less about, was it an effective way of curbing overdose deaths, or is it more a visible problem now that you may notice somebody who you perceive to be on drugs in your neighborhood? And so I think it comes to this issue, there's the push and pull, right? There is progress in one direction of considering it a healthcare issue, not something that is necessarily totally outside of one person's control, but not something that can necessarily be taken on and addressed solo with enough conviction of will for every person. And people don't deserve to die. That shouldn't be a controversial statement. But I think that there is this pushback to it, especially when it comes to putting our tax dollars to work to try to keep people from dying overdose deaths.
You're listening to LTAR, Let's Talk About Race, The Pill of Death, The Fentanyl Crisis in America.
I'll move on to my next question here that I alluded to a little bit, which is, what results from the fentanyl crisis being treated as a quote-unquote white problem? Obviously, we mentioned that the demographics there are shifting, not something that is necessarily widely known, but it isn't white men predominantly who are dying fentanyl overdose deaths anymore. Let's start with you, Professor Johnson.
There are a couple of things that come to mind about it being identified as a white problem and also a rural community problem. It got a different kind of attention. I think, as we've already discussed, there was a look at how do we help, starting to look at from a mental health perspective. And that was certainly never the position that was taken when it was primarily considered a Black community problem. By having a white face to that, the idea that you get your just desserts, or if you're using drugs, it's because, as you said, you're a flawed human, that there was some movement in a direction of recognizing that we were approaching this problem completely wrong. So I do think having a white face on it, in spite of the cynical reasons that happened, some good did come out of it. And I think some treatments came out of it, thinking about, you know, the ability to help people transition and understanding and recognizing that the kind of treatment facilities that we had and the approach to treatment had not been successful. So that pushed people to explore the medical community as well as the therapeutic community to explore different ways to address addiction. So those things happened. But at the same time, the Black community and also Hispanics demographically had significantly increased OD experience. And so that is the bad side, the flip side of the attention that identifying it as a white addiction problem happened. Even though there are a lot of states that are continuing some of the war on drugs, you know, kind of laws, you know, the maximum sentence, Mississippi, I think, and Louisiana is a state that still has a 5-year required sentence for possession. But there are a few states that are at least moving in the right direction. What I'm concerned about is decriminalization isn't the total answer. You can't have decriminalization and not have the support in place for people. And I know that Oregon, as a part of exploring decriminalization of drugs and the decisions that were made, there are other places that have done it successfully, but the difference was they had health care.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Let's go to Cecil.
It was seen as a health crisis and not a criminal problem. That is good. However, one of the results is that as more emphasis and resources were targeted to white communities, as is so often the case, resources were not sent to Black and brown communities. So that even though Black and brown people were impacted severely by this crisis, the little bit of money that one would hope would have been targeted to Black and brown communities were not. And as is so often the case, resources were targeted to the dominant community, the white communities. One of the challenges we face is moving beyond the habit of separating and treating Black and brown people as a problem, so that what we saw throughout the history of the war on drugs, as others have shared, is that Black and brown people were seen as criminals. We need to arrest them. We need to put them in jail, and because they are bad people. What people have observed is that when it was seen as a white problem, it was seen maybe as it was seen as a severe problem, but it wasn't seen as related to the moral and the integrity of the white person who was addicted to these drugs. It was something that they needed help. It wasn't because they were bad or immoral people. And until we expand our understanding, we will continue to see ways in which communities are not only targeted, but are viewed as problem communities, and that the solution is jail and imprisonment rather than health care and treatment.
Thank you. Let's go to Nia.
So the irony, I guess, of this white face on the current drug problem, it resulted from historically racist medical practices. And I know that LTAR, we've had different discussions about racism in the medical field. And what studies have shown is that historically, doctors have had, you know, a racial bias against Black bodies. And when these opioids came out and the companies were pushing it to the doctors saying, hey, it's safe, give it to your patients that are hurt, don't worry, they won't get addicted. The doctors were reluctant to prescribe those painkillers to people of color initially because of those racist attitudes. For so long, doctors mistakenly have believed, and I'm sure a lot of them still believe today, that Black bodies physically feel less pain than white bodies. So they were reluctant to prescribe these drugs to people of color, even when they came in and they probably needed some type of prescription for that. And then secondly, what the thread that Reverend Cecil and Professor Johnson and Althea, we've all been talking about, is sort of that thread of the narrative of the Black substance abuse issue. But again, when it comes to the Black person that has a drug addiction, that it's a moral problem, it's a character problem. And so doctors had this bias that Blacks, hey, they're essentially more morally corrupt than white people. And if we prescribe this to them, they might misuse it or they might end up selling it. And so that's, you know, where we got to the point where this was a rural problem and this was affecting white communities disproportionately than Blacks. Well, now we've got some, you know, sort of equal drugs. Everything's sort of equalized out. But again, Reverend Cecil talked about and Professor Johnson talked about is that classifying this less of a criminalization issue and more of a public health issue, we could make some progress on this. But the issue is the stigma of substance abuse, right? Maybe politicians and society at large are reluctant to call this a public health emergency, although that would release all kind of resources and education, like some of the things that we really need in addition to what we're doing now. I don't know. For some reason, our country is so slow to destigmatize health crises, like the mental health crisis. Now people feel that they can talk openly about mental health issues where there may not have been the case 20, 30 years ago, and also obesity. So when we don't destigmatize these things and have these conversations, I feel like we all lose. So I'm hopeful that we can make some progress with substance abuse as a public health emergency as we have with other health crises we deal with today.
Thank you all. I would echo what Nia was saying there, that we have enough historical record, if I may say so, to say that criminalization alone does not help people not be addicted to drugs. And in fact, we really need a multi-pronged approach. There are harm reduction strategies, there are rehab facilities, there's also destigmatizing and addressing the mental health crisis aspect of it, the economic aspects of it, what motivates or what brings someone to find themselves addicted to this type of drug, which now the opioid is not necessarily something that comes prescribed from your doctor when you got hurt at work, but is now $5 on the street, astonishingly cheap. And that people want to pursue that to begin with, I think is important to recognize. And also the ways in which the strategies that have gotten some steam, I suppose, or have gotten more accepted, the ways in which those are adapted to white rural men who were in the first wave of those impacted. And that those strategies, as other folks here have mentioned, one, aren't adapted to all users now, and two, are often inaccessible entirely or considered to be out of reach of somebody, especially people of color, when we're talking about harm reduction strategies like buprenorphine, which is a drug that helps to not have people overdose and is a replacement to take yourself off of fentanyl. That's something that is not entrusted to addicts to be able to start to break the cycle. And I think another thing that I would like to bring up here is thinking about the mental picture of the addict and how that has changed and how race and how different drugs have impacted different groups changes our image of who is an addict how morality plays into that, and how, you know, as the general, I guess I keep talking about taxpayers, but, you know, the general public wants to enforce things upon that person. And addiction is a really tricky issue. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. It's not as if, hey, if we give everybody $15, they're not going to be an addict anymore. It's a multi-pronged, complex thing that is difficult to hold in one hand. And instead, there's oftentimes either some kind of stereotype or inability to grapple with the complexity of it all.
You are listening to LTAR, Let's Talk About Race, The Pill of Death, The Fentanyl Crisis in America.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Let's go to the next question here. What is the impact of harm reduction strategies? Let's talk about it. Why don't we start with Cecil?
In the 1990s, I did a lot of work around HIV prevention and education and treatment. One of the things that we found and discovered that was necessary was to approach this crisis through the lens of a harm reduction model. What that meant in part was that those who were sharing drugs, needles, were more likely to share needles where the virus was contained in the needles. So they were more likely to become infected with HIV. What was then thought of as a somewhat revolutionary idea was this harm reduction model. So we have to toss away all our sense of being moral police and saying, what can we do to actually help people? And what we discovered and what we did was that by allowing those who are addicts, by giving them clean needles, if and when they use, they would be less likely to get HIV from a, quote, dirty needle. The harm reduction model works because I think it takes people from where they are and saying, this is where you are. How do we get to point B? There is, as others have stated, no one-size-fit-all. And the harm reduction theories and harm reduction ways of addressing this crisis is a compassionate way in which we allow people to get the help they need where they need it and when they need it. It might seem odd and difficult for people, but for those who are impacted, who are at that point where their lives are in danger, anything we can do to help reduce the harm that they might face is good. And so I think we have advanced to some degree past that way of thinking, which forbid us to think of harm reduction strategies. I think this is healthy, that way in which to address this crisis, and I hope we continue to find creative, healthy, and transformative ways to address the crisis, the opioid crisis.
Thank you. I think for me, when I think about harm reduction, the first thing is centering the idea that the most important thing is that people don't die. That's the main goal. And with fentanyl and opioids in particular, there are some good strategies to tackle that. And that's why this sort of third wave opioid crisis with the xylazine animal tranquilizer that doesn't have a reversal or any kind of antidote is really scary. But for opioids, there is such a thing as Narcan. There is naloxone, the overdose reversal drug. Let's think about it. It could be as widespread as the Heimlich or as CPR. It could be that every store on the block has Narcan and naloxone in their first aid kit in order to be able to support in this way. That could be something that we tackle. The other thing to think of is, I mean, obviously there's quite a few different ways, but safe consumption sites, safe injection sites, places where people who are addicted can have support so that they don't overdose is critically important. Another thing that I would add here, it doesn't totally fit with what we're saying, but I do think that it is worth talking about as we're thinking about moving away from an addict as a moral framework, as something that somebody should not be morally. There are a lot of structures around drug addiction and drug treatment that are built on the fact that people are treated as morally bad. There are a lot of limitations, there's no trust, and it asks a lot of people. For example, methadone users, people who are trying to get off meth, there's a lot of restrictions and punishments and ways that, you know, the average person, if these kinds of restrictions were put on them, it would make life feel utterly unmanageable. But that is what is asked of folks who are addicted to a substance. That's something that I just wanted to bring up, especially because there is this compassion gap that I think that we're seeing here, as other folks have identified.
Althea is right. There is one question we are not asking. How and why is the pain of life and living causing people to alter their reality? A reality filled with so much pain. This has been LTAR, Let's Talk About Race, The Pill of Death, The Fentanyl Crisis in America.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Previously on Let's Talk About Race, LTAR discusses gun violence in America, as American as cherry pie.
I want to talk about the underpinnings of this epidemic and go way, way back. And I want to go back and say that I believe this epidemic started with the theft of the land from indigenous people and the theft from the land of its resources and attributes from the enslavement of Africans. State-sanctioned enforcement of these two economic realities through the use of violence represented by gun. And if we can understand who had them, who did not, who got to use them, who did not, the origins of police as the vigilante groups to return enslaved people to the enslavers. That, I think, is the origins of this. And it is over these, the years of this country has been co-opted into a white supremacy culture that uses this agenda against Black and Indigenous people of color, women, domestic violence, the others, and of which we all are.
I think it's important to acknowledge that the gun violence, the violent epidemic that we are experiencing now, while it is horrible, it is based on the legacy of violence in this nation. We all recognize and remember the wise observation of, I believe, H. Rapp Brown, who says violence is American as cherry pie. And I think if we look at the history of this nation, it is rooted in violence and oppression of peoples. From the initial entry of European invaders into this nation where they massacre indigenous people, to the importation of Africans into this nation, through the continued effort to uplift the powerful, violence is part of who we are. And to offer a different perspective is to go against the natural grain of our society.
To truly look at the issue is to be overwhelmed. To understand it is to be bombarded with the enormity of it all, right? But the first word in gun violence is gun. That has to be a big part of it. And we are in a unique society that wants to waffle on that topic. In 23 states, I believe, brass knuckles are banned. We can ban weapons. That's allowed. Switchblades, a lot of places are banned. You know, you can't go into a sporting arena with certain things on your person. It is not unreasonable that living in a society, there are certain things we're not going to do so that we can all get along. And the underpinnings of gun violence are, of course, what my fellow panelists have pointed out. This legacy of white supremacist, male-dominated violence that has been enacted towards all peoples in our society, and including to other white men. A lot of victims of gun violence are white men. A lot of perpetrators of gun violence are white men. The guns play a big part in it. They're very, very lethal.
The common thread is gender in terms of between and among perpetrators. Men are by far and away the ones who are utilizing this tool called a gun in these mass shootings. I think when we understand or look at the statistics for suicide and for accidental shooting and the shooting of children, that dynamic changes a little bit. However, when we are talking about these mass events, we're talking about men, and we're talking predominantly, I'm going to say it, white men. The common thread, that's not exclusive, I'm very much aware of that. The common threads are what we were just talking about in the last question, which is economics and racism and white supremacy culture. And I want to be super clear that my vision of freedom and equity and equality for women, for people of color, for all sorts of different folks is not that we can get to take up the tools of the oppressor and use them against ourselves. That is not my idea of liberty. That is not my idea of freedom. That is not my idea of having arrived in terms of full access to and benefit from the benefits of the society and culture. It's a pretty simple through line for me. It's based in gender. It's based in misogyny. It's based in racism. And in the end, it's based in economics. And once we understand that, I hope it becomes easier to see where we might take half measures to try to address some of what we're seeing here and hopefully prevent.
You can look at other developed nations in the world and compare the number of gun deaths. And there's a big disparity there, even if you want to go per capita. They do not have the access to guns that Americans have. And what has the access to guns gotten us, aside from living in terror?
You know, whenever there's a mass shooting or whenever there is terrible activity or terrible crime, we often see commentators come and pontificate about why this has happened, whether it's social, what's wrong with our society, what's wrong with our education system, what's wrong with our families. And among the common threads, I think of perpetrators, they all have access to guns. Violence did not begin with guns and will not end with the elimination of guns. What's common among all the common thread we see is at least access to guns, whether it is, you know, someone who had training in the military or whether it's someone who had access to their parents' locked up gun closet, whether it is someone who was able to go into the corner gun store and buy a gun, or someone who had access from a friend or stole a gun. What is common is the numbers of guns in our society. In the United States, where there are more guns than there are individuals, think that is a problem, and that we must recognize that our society is not so unique than other society, and that the level of gun violence is so much higher in this nation than in about any other nation. So we have to say, what is wrong with our nation that we have access to so many guns? And, you know, certainly, as I noted, that guns and violence is part of our nation's history, and is part of our, some might say, our DNA. But I think it's also the possibility that we can resist that, and we do not have to say, well, it has always been and so it will always be.
These personal grievances or workplace grievances or something that was a specific challenge that has driven people to do such a heinous act, then the question becomes, we don't all go out and shoot people when we get divorced or we get demoted or we lose a job. So what is it? What is that factor that's different here and that puts a gun in the hand of a person, and that's the decision that they make?
We all as humans are able to experience rage and depression and grief and have challenges with our mental health, all the feels. That is not, from my perspective, what's wrong with this situation. What is going wrong in this situation is that when we have all these feels, we have way too easy access to guns that have such an incredible lethality to them. So again, this common sense piece of, you know, that old tried thing, like, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, people have those feelings. I can completely agree with that. We all experiencing these ups and downs of life. However, when certain individuals have these feelings, they have way too easy access to guns, and guns are so lethal.
How do we meet challenges? How do we engage with one another? How do we resist so much in ways that are life-affirming rather than life-denying? It's a hard, difficult question. And I think that we will begin to answer that when we begin to ask hard questions about who we are and not who we think we are.
The feeling of helplessness, what can, what would, this feeling of complete inadequacy to have any impact or to be able to understand enough to be able to have impact. And I think we've got to fight against that as hard as we can, because it plays into the dynamic of we cannot know, we cannot understand, thus we can do nothing. And in the face, in the vacuum of doing nothing, these kind of horrific acts of violence continue to move forward. And I feel almost like common sense might drive us or show us a pathway towards some type of action. And I am a person who believes that even incrementalism has its role, has its moment. And if we could just make things a little bit better, maybe it's not the universal panacea, but if we could just make things a little less worse, harm reduction, could we practice our harm reduction in this movement?
Those were excerpts from our show, Let's Talk About Race, Gun Violence in America, as American as Cherry Pie. Thanks for taking a look back with us. All of our previous episodes can be found online by searching Let's Talk About Race, LTAR, and listen to us regularly on your local community radio station.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by
Grassroot News Northwest. Catch previous episodes on Apple Podcast or SoundCloud under LTAR or Let's Talk About Race. Thank you for listening.
I'm Mr. KBOO Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
In 2020, Portland saw unprecedented protests for racial justice and widespread criticism of the Portland police and the institution of policing itself. It's now been almost 3 years since over 80% of Portland voters approved changing the city charter to create a new civilian-led police oversight system. The Police Accountability Commission has been hammering out the details, and their plan goes before City Council at the end of August. Totality of Circumstances will be hosting the commissioners live on KBOO on Tuesday, July 25th, and you can call in with questions or comments about the proposal. You can also send us questions at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio@gmail.com. Join us on July 25th from 5 to 6 p.m. and make your voice heard.
You.